Labor for Monday, May 20th, 2013. And before we get started, and if you're here for Senate Bill 96, we're going to be carrying that over till the 29th of May. So just want to let people know. Okay, so open a public hearing on Senate Bill 528. Jan, if you could read the summary, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, the major changes makes changes to the Oregon Credit Union Act. Allows credit unions operating in Oregon to have the same powers and authorities offered to federal credit unions or credit unions chartered under laws of another state. Requires credit union to notify DCBS of intention to exercise parity powers at least 45 days before exercising such powers. Requires notice include description of power and statutory, regulatory, or other legal basis for which for use of federal credit union power. Clarifies the role and function of supervisory committees and the role of the board of directors. Raises the cap on aggregate loan amount to one borrower from the greater of $15,000 or 15% of the credit union's equity. Raises it to $100,000 or 15% of the credit union's equity. Allows the board to delegate declaration of dividends without board approval. Provides protection from personal liability to the director or the officer who uses good faith or due care to form reasonable belief for actions in the best interest of credit union or who reasonably relies upon expert or competent and reliable outside opinions. There are no amendments before you. Came on a Senate vote of 29-0. There's no revenue impact. There's no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you.
Pam? Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Pam Levitt with the Northwest Credit Union Association. Thank you so much for your time to hear Senate Bill 528 today. As Jan mentioned, it did receive a 29-0 vote on the Senate side. We're going to explain the bill to you briefly. Senate Bill 528 is the work of our committees who review the Oregon Credit Union Act every 2 years to see what kinds of updates and changes are needed. As you know, the financial services marketplace changes regularly, and we feel like we need to have an Oregon Credit Union Act that keeps up with those changes. As you know, credit unions are not-for-profit financial cooperatives. We're organized to meet the needs of our members. We're democratically controlled and owned by our members, and as locally owned, not-for-profit financial institutions, credit unions have a very high social mission, community service, financial education, outreach, and philanthropy are part of our DNA, and credit unions were invented on the concept of people helping people. Oregon credit unions have done very well in the last few years, even during these difficult times in financial crisis. We're out there serving our members, helping support them during these difficult times, helping them with loans, helping them get out of their difficult financial times. I'm thrilled today to release to all of you our annual Community Reinvestment Report. I just wanted to let you know that this is something that you'll see from us annually. In the report, it says that more than 1.3 million Oregonians belong to a credit union. 90% of likely voters polled in January share a positive positive impression of the credit union in their communities. In 2012, Oregon credit unions provided $100 million in direct financial benefits to Oregonians. Oregon credit unions had more than $796 million outstanding small business loans in December of 2012. And finally, one of the highlights, a survey of 36 of the 70-plus credit unions in the report found they contributed more than $2.4 million in cash, 46,000 volunteer hours, and $800,000 in staff time in 2012. So we're wanting to show you what credit unions are doing in all of your communities. Obviously, we're here for Senate Bill 520, but I just wanted to share with you the annual release of this report. And I'll have the gentleman give you a brief explanation of Senate Bill 528. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Scott. Yeah.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Scott Burgess. I'm president and CEO of Rivermark Community Credit Union. We're a community-based credit union based out of Beaverton, Oregon. We serve approximately 63,000 members across 11 counties in Oregon. And we I've got more information in my submitted testimony on Rivermark and also on the good things that credit unions across Oregon are doing in the community. And Pam touched on some of that already, and also the unique nature of credit unions. But what I wanted to do this morning is just take a few moments to talk about the process that credit unions in Oregon have gone through in order to come up with this proposed legislation. As Pam mentioned, credit unions are member-owned, not-for-profit, and it's very important because of that member ownership that we are very sensitive to the needs of our members, our owners of the credit union. And with the economic environment changing fairly rapidly, the financial condition of our members changing rapidly and the needs changing, I think it's important that the state law, our Credit Union Act, keeps pace with these changes. And so, as Pam mentioned, every couple of years we come together, credit union CEOs and executives from across the state of Oregon, to review the law and to talk about the needs of our members and how we can best serve them and how we may be able to change the Oregon Credit Union Act so that we can be more efficient in the way we deliver those services. So we've done that. That's how this bill comes before you. We've also reviewed it not only with credit union CEOs from across the state of Oregon, also with our association and with our regulator, and we are not aware of any opposition at this time. And in terms of the details of the bill, I'll defer to Mr. Scoggins, but I would be available for questions if you have any. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Good morning, Chair Daugherty, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley Wada Witt. We're the outside counsel to the Northwest Credit Union Association, as well as a number of credit unions throughout Oregon and Washington. And I've worked with the association and the credit unions in the drafting of the language for the bill. I've got written testimony in front of you that goes section by section, and in the interest of time, I won't go through the whole bill, but I would like to just point out three of the highlights. This really is what I would call a technical bill, nothing hugely earth-shattering in it, but really kind of making some improvements in the rules that govern us to streamline and modernize and update the Act, and to answer and resolve some questions that have been outstanding for some time. The first issue that I would point out is some changes related to governance, and that's really clarifying the roles of the supervisory committee and the board and how they interrelate with each other. The supervisory committee serves as kind of the financial oversight committee, auditing the financial statements and having a bit of a watchdog function, internal control function. There's some language in the Act that's been there for a long time that really kind of muddles that and made it appear as if the supervisory committee had some role in management as well, and really it's more of a watchdog and reporting role to the board and to the members of the credit union. So we cleaned that up to be sure that the roles of each of those bodies are clear, the board and the supervisory committee. We've also made some changes to some of the duties that are specified for the board of directors, primarily among them allowing the board to delegate to management the ability to, quote, declare dividends, because it's really more of an interest rate setting function and mechanical paying of interest that belongs in the management role as opposed to the board of directors. Second, also related to governance, for years credit union professionals and attorneys have assumed, but we don't have any real Oregon case law or Oregon statutes that have indicated that the same rules, I should say, that govern the fiduciary duties of directors of for-profit corporations would also govern the fiduciary duties of directors of credit unions and how those are carried out and what the standards of liability for a credit union director are. And so what we've done is take the rules that are set forth in the Profit Corporation Act, ORS Chapter 60, and incorporate those into ORS Chapter 723 for credit unions, so that if this were to come up in a court case, there would be no question as to what the rules are. We don't have to assume anymore. Now we've got it spelled out in the statute. And then the last change that I would point out is we've done what I would call streamlining and modernization of what's called the parity power, where Oregon State Chartered Credit Unions have the authority to exercise any power that is available to a federal credit union in the state of Oregon. Previously, what the language of that power said was you have to go through a process of applying to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. They have to make a finding that it equalizes the convenience and advantage of citizens and the competition between state and federal credit unions. And most states don't have it set up that way. In most states, that power is self-executing. And so what this bill does is change it to match that. The federal parity power would be self-executing. We don't have to go through a process of applying for and receiving approval anymore in order for a state chartered credit union to exercise the power that's available to a federal credit union. And finally, we've also added, with the advent of more and more state chartered credit unions from other states that are doing business in Oregon and vice versa to a certain extent, we have added a what I would call a state parity power provision, where if a state chartered credit union from another state like Washington is doing business in Oregon, then Oregon credit unions have the authority to look at powers available to that state credit union that's now competing head-to-head with Oregon credit unions and exercise those powers. This state parity power, however, would be subject to approval by the Department of Consumer and Business Services, primarily because we're not just dealing with one type of organization now, federal credit unions. Now we're looking at organizations potentially from a whole bunch of other states, and the DCBS needs to have some more review and oversight of that. So that's a brief hit of the highlights, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Representative Barton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have two or three questions, if I may.
Please.
I'll start with the easy one. Well, it's all easy. But, I'm a credit union member. I appreciate what you guys do. But going to the end there where we essentially are we're putting in statute the business judgment rule, is that the exact language? Is the purpose of this basically to graft the existing corporate and nonprofit business judgment rule, red flag rule, fiduciary duties, etc., and make it very explicit on the Credit Union Act?
Chair Doherty, Representative Barton, that is correct. It's the language isn't precisely the same, but the intent is the same, and the language is, you know, as close as we could get it under the circumstances.
Well, are there any substantive differences that we're doing for any conscious reason?
No, there are none. Okay. And Chair Doherty, Representative Barton, as I understand it, based on the language that we have in the Act or in this bill, a court looking at a case involving a credit union director should evaluate it and come to the same conclusion as if it were a for-profit corporation.
Thank you. That's what I thought, but that's now the legislative history is perfectly clear, and I think that should clear that up. Now, changing topics somewhat, if I may, Madam Chair, to what I think is the most interesting part of the bill is Section 2, and that is the parity clause. Now, I just want to make sure I understand this right. So right now, the existing law, pretend this bill didn't, is that DCBS has the approval to grant, has the authority to grant approval to a state-chartered credit union to basically operate as under the same rules as a federally chartered credit union could do, subject to that prior approval. But what we're doing is saying that state, if we pass this bill, is that state-chartered credit unions, they don't have to obtain prior approval to operate as though a federal, as under the same regs potentially as a federally chartered credit union under subsection 1 of Section 2, and that subsection 2, we're also extending this to credit unions in, chartered in other states, but they would be subject to the prior approval from DCBS. Did that make sense, and did I get that right?
Chair Doherty, Representative Barton, yes.
Okay.
To answer briefly,
yeah. I got it right. I'm not sure it made sense.
To elaborate a little bit, the way that the federal parity power previously worked, as you said, credit unions would have to go to DCBS and get authority, and you know, that's not the end of the world, obviously, but there's a process involved and red tape, so to speak. Savings banks have the same type of provision in their act, but does not require DCBS approval, and so this essentially makes the credit union version similar to the version that's there for Oregon savings banks. On the issue of state chartered credit unions, as you noted, state chartered credit unions would have to exercise a power that's available to a Washington state chartered credit union operating in Oregon. Oregon state chartered credit unions would have to go to DCBS and obtain approval.
So if I may, and I love credit unions more than most, but there's something about that makes me nervous. And I think anyone who loves the legislature can perhaps relate, because we're delegating tremendous authority to DCBS. Essentially, in fact, in theory, depending on what other states were doing, it could undermine the entire act in a sense, because DCBS would have the authority to mirror the lowest regulatory system of any other state. Does that make sense? Is that why should I not be nervous about this? Can you help me feel better? Because it really troubles
me. I can. Chair Doherty, Representative Barton, members of the committee, here's why I would say that while you might be afraid in that way, here's why that shouldn't be a concern, is that to start with, the legislature has already said in the Credit Union Act that out-of-state credit unions can operate in Oregon under certain parameters and conditions. And that's all that the legislature has already said about out-of-state credit unions operating in Oregon. The details of that have been left to the DCBS. They have authority to approve and disapprove requests from out-of-state credit unions to operate in Oregon and to specify conditions under which they can operate in Oregon and restrictions and things like that. So the legislature has already set up a scheme under which out-of-state state chartered credit unions can operate in Oregon. And this essentially says that the DCBS can look at that, and if necessary, in order to give our Oregon credit unions something that they need to do to compete with those credit unions that are already operating in Oregon, then they have that authority. But it's really only extending, you know, in a very incremental way, what is already happening there. And I would add that it is also restricted to out-of-state credit unions that are actually operating and have already been approved by the DCBS to operate in the state of Oregon. You can't just look at a credit union in Florida that has no connection with Oregon and say, we want the powers that they have. They have to already be operating in Oregon and be subject to DCBS authority, and it's only powers that are available to them in Oregon. And so there's really...
That does business. Yeah, I see that on page 3 of line 2. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions, Representative Woldy?
Thank you. After that discussion, I think Representative Barton led off with, does this make sense and am I correct? And I'm not sure if it totally makes sense to me yet, but I think it does. I guess my question is do state chartered credit unions, if this bill were to pass, do they have parity with out of state credit unions who decide to operate in Oregon? I mean, is the playing field basically level between those two entities?
Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey, the playing field is, I guess I would say, as level as we can probably make it be. We would be able to have Oregon State Chartered Credit Unions exercise powers that are available to those other credit unions, subject to concerns or restrictions or other requirements that are placed by the DCBS. And so it's not unfettered authority, but yes, they do have equality now with out-of-state credit unions, if this bill passes, that would be operating in the state of Oregon, which they don't necessarily have now.
Follow up? Thank you for that. It was my my major concern is that an out-of-state credit union who an out-of-state state chartered credit union who decides to operate in Oregon doesn't come into the state with less regulatory authority than our in-state state chartered credit unions. That's where I was where my concern was.
Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey, that's an excellent concern, and I would. My belief is that that is already addressed in the current act because of the fact that they would have to apply for permission from the DCBS, and they do. We have a few that are operating in the state of Oregon now, subject to DCBS approval authority and examination and oversight as well.
Thank you.
Pam? Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Pam Levitt again. There are less than five. There are less than five out-of-state credit unions, state chartered, operating in Oregon. And most of the ones that are in Oregon that I know of are here because they have a very strong membership base. I know that one is surrounded near a timber mill, and they had a lot of membership, or through a merger situation. So it's I just don't want you to think there's all these out-of-state chartered credit unions operating in the state. There are not. There are very few, although as this legislation is drafted, we're always looking to the future. What is the future going to look like? So if an out-of-state credit union is operating and they're able to offer a certain product or services that is not allowed by the Oregon Credit Union Act, this is the reason for, that's the intent of this section of the legislation.
Thank you. Go ahead.
If I could just add one more thing, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. Years ago, as Pam mentioned, this really is a forward-looking thing to a certain extent. Years ago, before the Regal-Neal legislation passed at the federal level for banks, it was primarily national banks and federal credit unions that operated on a multi-state basis. And there was a lot of technical difficulty in state-chartered institutions operating across state lines. With Regal-Neal passing a number of years ago on the bank side, and with credit union regulators really looking to parallel that, it's much more common now for state-chartered institutions to operate across state lines. And that's only going to continue on into the future. And so, again, looking forward, that's part of why we wanted this in there.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you very much. Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 520A, and I'm going to open an informational hearing. What we've got here is we talked quite a bit with about the savings plan and the retirement.
Let me just interrupt for a second. There was no other testimony and no opposition.
No other testimony, no other opposition.
We ought to have that on the record.
Thank you very much.
Clarify that.
Thank you very much. But to make sure we have enough time for our folks that are in here to talk about a different kind of savings plan and what they've been doing in the state of Oregon, we're going to be having an informational hearing on that. There's a lot of information and a lot of concern about people saving money for retirement. And so what we have an informational hearing today, and it's the Oregon Assets Building and the Oregon Individual Development Account Initiative, which I think a lot of them came to your offices and talked, and once they came, and I thought this is a very unique and interesting program, and so I thought we could have some information on it. So with that, we want to call up Janet Bird, Rebecca Barger.
Wait, this panel.
Janet Bird, Ray Espana, and Jesse Beeson. And we have till 10 o'clock. And that's with questions.
Okay.
Just want to let you know. Thank you. Make sure you introduce yourself for your testimony.
Thank you. So I'll go ahead and start while my colleagues are getting settled. My name is Janet Bird, and I am the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships, and really pleased to be here today. Thank you for making time to talk about asset building. What we want to do is give you a little bit of framework for thinking about asset building and share some a framework and some data that's been collected by a national organization. And then we're going to spend time talking about the Oregon Individual Development Account Initiative, which is an effort that has been going in Oregon since 1999 that Neighborhood Partnerships has the honor of sort of spearheading on behalf of the state. So we have folks here who'll talk about what's going on in Oregon communities. So just to start, you know, when we talk about asset building, I like to sort of remind myself and remind other folks that what we're really talking about is the American dream, and which is also the Oregon story, that belief that if we work hard, that we can get by and that we can make a better life for ourselves and for our kids and leave something for our kids. We all, I think, know many really powerful stories about economic opportunity and success. This definition on the slide is one of the first ones that appeared in print, and I think it's still pretty resonant, talking about how everyone, no matter where they're born, whatever those circumstances are, should be able to have opportunity. What we know about life in Oregon today is that it's a little bit different. We know that 1 in 5 Oregon families is living in poverty. 1/3 couldn't stay above the poverty line if they lost their main source of income for 3 months. And that goes across all income levels. So even people who are making what you'd think of as a pretty good income, if that income disappeared, they don't have the savings, they don't have the reserves to stay out of poverty for 3 months. We keep hearing that we're the first generation of Americans that doesn't believe and doesn't know that we're going to be able to make life better for the kids that we're bringing up. So when we talk about asset building, we're really talking about what can we do as a community, as a society, to right this? How can we sort of get ourselves as a community back on the right track? Our colleagues at a national organization called CFED, Corporation for Enterprise Development, have developed a framework, and I've passed out some of their materials, and focused on financial security that looks not only at the data of sort of where we are, but what we can do at the state level, at the state policy level, to help kind of turn that around. And this schematic is a really basic explanation of that. What we know from experience and from research, and we'll share a little bit about some of the research that we've done about the Oregon IDA initiative, Individual Development Account Initiative, is that really small things can make a difference. There's been a lot of attention lately to the statistic that if a child has a college savings account, even if it's a tiny amount of money, they're 7 times more likely to go to college. So just the idea that folks know that they're creating that opportunity, that they're creating that savings, changes life prospects in a big way. So what this schematic shows is sort of the 5 basic pillars that we look at when we think about policy around asset building, and they're iterative. We learn. We learn financial education. We get good foundational education. That helps us improve our earning capacity, gives us better opportunity to earn wages, and then save. And even folks making very low incomes can figure out ways to put money aside, and we as a community, as a state, can create incentives for saving that work for folks across the income spectrum. Folks then can invest. One of the biggest ways we invest in this community is home ownership. That remains even with foreclosure and some of the bad things that we've seen, home ownership still remains the best strategy for building and investing for the future. And then kind of across the bottom, we need strong consumer protection. We need to be able to know that folks who have managed to save are going to be able to retain that. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about this. I've given you the data so that I know in the middle of session is not a good time to process new information, but I've given you the data and the framework just to kind of show you that there are possibilities. We would really love an opportunity to come back in the months to come and talk about some of these specifics. But in each of these 5 quadrants, CFED has done a lot of research about what's been done in other states, what has been proven to work in terms of state policy that will really help build assets for folks starting at the bottom of the income spectrum. Several of these you've had the opportunity to talk about already this session. A couple of them you're going to have more opportunity to talk about. Obviously, there's a lot of focus on the K-12 budget, which is key to asset building, giving kids that beginning. The look at what happens with early learning is also a real key to that. Within the earning quadrant, the earned income tax credit is a key piece of asset building and helping folks earn and keep what they earn. And you're going to have the opportunity to renew and extend that tax credit, hopefully expand it beyond the 6% that it is right now. Saving, as I said, we'll talk a lot about state support for IDA, for the Individual Development Account Program. College savings incentives, there's also been a lot of conversation about the Individual Development Account Initiative is one way to help folks save for college. Obviously, we need to do more with that. Protection, you will have the opportunity in just a few short minutes to vote on the foreclosure bill, which is one part of protecting the assets that folks have, giving folks the opportunity to think about what happens when they're underwater or can no longer pay their mortgage. So again, I'm not going to spend much time at all on slide five. What CFPB has done, though, is across this quadrant, across the policies that they identify as being really critical, they actually go in and grade the states. And so the scorecard that I passed out has this information on the back. Where can we as a state look at improving what we're doing for asset building? And then you'll see in the center there are a lot of data points that look quantifiably how are we doing across all of these different metrics. We are very much recognized for the strength of the Individual Development Account initiative that we have going here. We're also recognized as having a strong EITC. Again, that needs to be extended. And then the final point that I want to make today is this was some research that we had done by a group called Decision Metrics that just really looked at what we're doing as a state to encourage savings and how in our tax code, and we see this replicated nationally, that within the tax code there are a lot of incentives for saving. There's incentive to save for retirement. There's incentive to purchase a home through the home mortgage interest deduction. Many of those are mirrored at the state level. Most of those benefits are structured, and you know, just by happenstance or whatever, those benefits have been structured over the years, so they benefit folks at the highest income levels. What we really are urging all of us to think about is what can we do to encourage those benefits, to put that state support and resource across the income levels. So with that, I think I'm going to turn it over to Ray Espana, who's going to talk a little bit more about the just sort of the importance of asset building.
We'll just hold our questions till the panel's done, if that's okay. Yes, sir.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, it's a blessing to be with you. I'm Ray Espana. I direct community development at the Native American Youth and Family Center in Portland. We're an urban Indian program, and we serve over 300 various tribes throughout the country who have migrated to the Portland metro area. I'm here today to speak to you not just about a Native or Indigenous perspective, but just how the impact of wealth-building activities is in the communities of color, impacts the communities of color. The work that we've done in Portland, per se, has been to look at the various growing economic disparities over time that those communities have suffered, either for failure of public policy or just barriers or challenges that exist in the community. To say the least, we believe in Portland, in the Portland metro area, that we've made a pretty good data case for the impact of various things. But how do you go about it? How do you go about the change? The idea of wealth building, asset building, is something that addresses, as Janet says, some very key fundamentals. that would have impact on generational poverty, and that is one aspect that the Native community knows far too well. Education is still the key. It's the outcomes of education greatly impact the ability to sustain a family and themselves above the poverty line. Generally speaking, the IDA program, asset building, are tools that an organization such as NAIA would use to kind of impact the individual or family situation. The conditions of child poverty means conditions of adult poverty. With respect to communities of color, especially low-income, ethnic and racial minorities and culture, they oftentimes lack the skills, abilities, and knowledge of how to exist or compete or process information in such a way that ensures economic and financial security. We have developed an approach, comprehensive, to provide stability to families and individuals. We found that once individuals can be stabilized, good things happen. Children attend school, adults can make a living, take care of themselves. The asset building strategies that work effectively are such that they are comprehensive in nature and provide the necessary tools for success. I will say that NAIA is relatively new to the asset building, and I think trying to convince the Native community of how to participate has taken time. And I don't think it's just unique to the Native community, but I think that the idea of not having a relationship with a financial institution, not being aware of knowledge or activities or how do you repair credit, it's easy to get credit, those things have produced damaging results for the Native community as well as other communities of color. When we started to produce savers and take them through a financial wellness, a financial education literacy effort, we found that the relationship that we had with our communities began to see benefits. And one particular benefit is that we've used it as a kind of a role model for other Native. So we've had individuals who have saved to purchase a home. We have impacted the startup of at least 20 micro-enterprises locally. We are working with our elders to keep them stably housed as part of an IDA program. So I think there can be many ramifications and impacts positively when individuals and families can become involved in a comprehensive asset building kind of initiative. With that, I would just close by saying that our organization is working with other communities of color to kind of make a coalescing effect on implementing culturally relevant and specific programs to meet the unique needs of those communities. I think the results have been promising, and we look for the future for a greater impact. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. President, and we just kind of keep an eye on time so the other panel will have some time. And I know we have a lot of questions, so we want to answer those too.
Great. Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Jesse Beeson. I'm the Executive Director of Proud Ground and a member of the Board of Directors of Neighborhood Partnerships. Thank you for the chance to be here today. I'm here to talk with you specifically about the Oregon Individual Development Account Initiative, how it works, and our evaluation process around the initiative. So one of the strategies called out by CFED for states to adopt is the Individual Development Accounts, or IDAs. IDAs are special savings accounts that allow individuals with low incomes and minimal assets to save for a specific purpose, to receive financial education and training around their financial goal, and then to receive matching funds when their savings goal is reached. IDAs have been proven to build financial resilience and change savings habits. And we are fortunate that Oregon has a strong IDA program, one of the largest in the country. It was created in 1999, modified it in 2003, and since then it has enjoyed steady growth and today serves individuals in 33 of Oregon's 36 counties. The IDA initiative brings together state government, nonprofit partners, and individuals in unique ways. And we have a diagram in your packet to help us illustrate the relationships that the IDA initiative really depends on. First of all, Oregon Housing and Community Services provides oversight on behalf of the state. They delegate program management and fundraising to Neighborhood Partnerships, which is a statewide nonprofit organization. Neighborhood Partnerships raises funds for the initiative using a state tax credit. And the tax credit allows individuals and businesses to make a contribution from anywhere from $1 to $100,000 to the initiative. In return, those individuals or businesses qualify for a credit of 75% of their contribution on their state taxes. Contributions are capped by agreement with legislative revenue at $10 million or $7.5 million in tax credits. The money raised through these contributions is distributed to partners who work throughout Oregon to help individuals develop those savings plans, reach their goals, and then earn those matching funds. It also pays for the administration and the evaluation of the initiative to know that we're having a meaningful impact. Several of our partners have joined us today to talk about their work, and the organization that I lead, Proud Ground, is also a partner in the initiative, using IDAs to help Oregonians with low incomes achieve and sustain homeownership. On this diagram, the individuals served by the initiative are on the bottom. Individuals ages 12 to 86, all with low incomes, work with the nonprofit organizations throughout the state. Another key component of the initiative is our evaluation process. So since 2007, Neighborhood Partnerships has worked with the Regional Research Institute at Portland State University to evaluate the impacts of the initiative. The evaluation looks at the immediate impacts of the IDAs on individual assets, but we're also interested in seeing the impacts over time and behavior, because that's really what asset building is about, long-term changes. And the evaluation shows clear impacts. All of the evaluation reports are available, but to summarize them, the evaluators note, quote, dramatic changes in financial behaviors, as well as increased confidence in their own competence. Changes in savings and budgeting habits were especially notable, contributing to improved financial circumstances and satisfaction. In fact, nearly 60% of IDA participants had an emergency fund, which is a key component of financial resilience. Many IDA participants reported maintaining important financial practices even 12 months after they completed their IDA experience. For example, 55% were still using a budget, in contrast to only 30% who said they used a budget prior to their IDA account. And 52% of participants still had an emergency fund to tide them over during difficult times.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions of the panelists? I do have one comment, because I come from I was a high school teacher in the olden days when we taught personal finance, and we taught it actually for an entire year, a semester of sophomores and a semester of seniors. And unfortunately, that kind of went to the wayside of No Child Left Behind. But is there more movement to try to have personal finance? And I know that they have it kind of as an elective sometimes in some of the schools, but is there more of a move to have a personal finance component in education?
Chair Doherty, there are a couple things going forward. There has been work to look across the elementary and high school curriculum standards in Oregon to see where financial education could be embedded. There's actually a lot of thinking that it needs to happen as early as like fourth and fifth grade, as you start to think about compounding interest and some of those fundamentals. So that work has been done. It's been a little hard to think about adding requirements into core curriculum right now, but some of that foundational work has been done. The other thing that's being done that's quite interesting is a financial education curriculum for social service agencies, so that the idea would be, and this has been done in a number of cities at this point, that anytime somebody starts to intersect with, you know, emergency rent assistance or something like that, they would get a little dose of financial education so that we could do some remedial work on some of those core standards. Because I think as a parent of now college students, we forget how hard it is to teach and impart those fundamentals of, you know, what does it mean to maintain a bank account, and they aren't getting that in school.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may have been out of the room, but I don't know who CFED is or what your mission is or anything of the sort.
So, Chair Doherty, Representative Witt, so Corporation for Enterprise Development is a national organization. Neighborhood Partnerships, which is the organization that I'm with, we partner with CFED as a state policy partner. And we use their scorecard as a sort of a guide and a template to think about state asset building policy. And I apologize that I didn't explain that more adequately.
Okay, thank you.
Who developed the scorecard and the criteria behind the measurement?
So Corporation for Enterprise Development, which is a national nonprofit. They've been around for about 25 years now. And they are a think tank looking at financial empowerment for folks with low incomes. They've done the scorecard for about 10 years now. We've been a partner with them on the scorecard for about five or six years. So they do work with partners to kind of say, you know, what's working in your state in terms of policy around asset building. If you were to look at their website on the scorecard pages, you'll see information similar to what some of the other legislative think tanks do, sample legislation, what's happened in other states when they've implemented the legislation. So it's just a resource that we use that we thought as we start to think about asset building policy at a state level that you might be interested in seeing.
Any other quick questions? I'd like to bring the other panel up if we could. Hey, thank you very much for coming
thank
and
you.
Spending your time. Excellent information.
Thank you.
Okay, the next ones we've got Rebecca Barger, Doug Cooper, and Emily Ryman. And we've got 10 minutes. We'll give you 12. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Barger. I work for NeighborWorks Umpqua, located in Roseburg, Oregon. And we are an IDA provider serving all of Southern and Central Oregon. Working in rural communities can be a challenge. Many of the counties that we serve have some of the highest unemployment in the state. Those who do have jobs frequently find themselves underemployed or with unpredictable, unsteady employment. Despite having barriers, rural folks want to save, and the IDA program is very successful down there. Many of the savers I work with are youth and adults starting or re-entering school. Post-secondary education is our largest IDA category, and for good reason. College is frequently beyond the reach of someone in rural Oregon. Not because of grades or motivation, but because of proximity and resources. When highly motivated students, despite their income, put their minds to it, college can be attainable and even affordable. I'm reminded of a student from Cave Junction, Cave Junction being a very small town. She wanted to go to an Ivy League school, but didn't know how she was going to be able to pay for it. She found out about the IDA program her sophomore year in high school and began saving. And in conjunction with Pell Grants and other scholarships, she's now pretty much covering all her expenses without debt at Yale. She's one of the many people using the IDA program not only to improve their career-potential options for the future, but also to remain debt-free. NeighborWorks Umpqua is a strong believer in the IDA program and sees it as an important and essential part of what we do in rural communities. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Emily Ryman, and I'm the Opportunity Works Manager at NEDCO. We are a CDC serving Lane, Marion, and Clackamas counties, and we've been providing homeownership education and counseling since the early 1990s. We are now a member of the IDA initiative, and our primary IDA category is in homeownership. What started off as a small program for 15 to 20 clients annually now serves more than 500 families each year. And of those, between 120 and 125 low-income families go on to purchase their first home after working with NEDCO. I think there's a common misconception for people outside of the homeownership field that assumes we must work with middle-class families because homeownership might not be attainable for low income. Just to give you a little frame of reference there, I wanted to give you the numbers from the past 2 years at NEDCO. Of the almost 250 families who purchased, 24% were below 50% of area median income when they began working at NEDCO, qualifying them as very low income. Another 57% were between 50 and 80% of area median income, meaning that fully 81% of the clients who purchased homes after working with us were low-income Oregonians. Why do those numbers matter, and why are we so proud of those 120 new homeowners each year? Homeownership has been and remains, despite the recent economic downturn, one of the best ways for low-income families to maintain financial security, to build assets, and I think most importantly, to pass those assets on to the next generation. We know, for example, that low-income homeowners have higher savings rates than their renting peers. We know that low-income homeowners often use the equity in their home to start small businesses or to help their children go to college. And we know that low-income seniors are far more financially stable when they own their home in retirement than those who continue to rent. And when families participate in pre-purchase education and counseling, the assets they gain actually go way beyond the house that they purchase. We often say in our classes that the journey is more important than the house at the end of the road. And the journey is about a family learning to live within their means, learning to use the resources that they have well, learning to increase their income earning potential, to stop relying on credit cards and to learn how to save first, and perhaps most importantly, to be educated and confident consumers who aren't at the mercy of predatory lenders or others in the market. The house is simply the goal or the dream at the end of the road that is enough to motivate people to do the hard work that is necessary to make those changes. And I think these soft skills actually lead to some of the best outcomes from home ownership: better educational attainment for low-income youth, less reliance on emergency social services, and better long-term financial stability for those families. Homeownership in general and low-income homeownership in particular are, of course, not without risk, but we know what makes them safer. And the brilliance of the IDA program is that it's perfectly designed to require and also to reward the very things that we know lead to the best outcomes and the most long-term stable homeownership. These include early access to financial and homeownership education and counseling, a pattern of budgeting and savings over time, and both a personal and a financial investment to take to the closing table. Most of our IDA participants have worked with us for at least a year, many of them for 2 years and some of them for 3 years. And we know that these things amount to successful homeownership. A recent study actually looked at IDA participants in the housing crisis and found that IDA participants had less than half the foreclosure rate of their low-income peer homeowners. So we know it works. And I want to hit, before I end...
If you could summarize so we have enough time for Mr. Cooper to speak.
Certainly. I just want to say that I think another part of asset building is also asset preservation. So I just want to hit on the importance of foreclosure prevention. And the mediation bill that is up for vote today, I think, is an important component of that. And to close, so that I don't end on the note of foreclosure, I just want to give you a quote from one of our most recent homeowners here in Salem. She's a young lady named Tiffany who said, "You know, not so long ago, I was a homeless woman living in a park. Words cannot express the gratitude I have for where I am today. I can't wait to go get the keys to my house and do the happy dance."
Thank you very much. Mr. Cooper?
Representative Doherty and members of the committee, thank you for hearing us this morning. My name is Doug Cooper. I'm the Deputy Director at Mercy Corps Northwest. We work in Oregon and Washington, and we focus primarily on small business development and self-employment for people with limited resources. Our goal is to help our participants create secure and productive lives for themselves and for their families, and by extension, to help build more secure and productive communities in our state. And we've been offering the small business IDAs since about 2004, and we're the second largest provider of the business IDAs in the state. We work primarily in the Portland metro area and had well over 1,000 participants in the 9 years we've been offering these. The IDAs have been a real key tool in supporting new and startup businesses. It fills a critical gap for our business owners in three different areas. First of all, it provides business education and planning. All of our IDA participants take a 6-week class with 25 other new business owners. They use this information to write and submit a business plan, including financial projections, before they graduate. Secondly, the program reinforces personal budget savings budgeting and saving skills. We require that they analyze their family budget and they meet monthly savings goals for at least 6 months, and that usually is 18 months period. Our graduates report that these budgeting and saving skills persist well beyond their participation in the IDA programs, and you've heard that echoed in your earlier testimony. Lastly, the IDA match provides debt-free capital for buying critical assets to grow their business. In our program, they can either save $1,000 or $2,000, and that's matched 3-to-1. And for new businesses, can help buy critical tools, equipment, or training for their business without the debt burden or the cash flow implications that come with debt capitalization, and increases their chances of success. In terms of the overall IDA initiative, business IDAs account for about 40% of the total accounts, and the average saving period is about 18 months with an average match of about $4,400. In follow-up surveys, 88% of the IDA graduates are still operating the businesses that they started with, and about 60% of those said that they were profitable, which is not a bad percentage for small businesses. All this indicates that this is a model that works well and gets the results that are intended. We've adopted the IDA model in classes that we teach on small business and entrepreneurship at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Wilsonville, which is Oregon's prison for women. Even though it's not officially part of the IDA initiative, we believe that the structure of the program is so sound and it's effective that we carried it into our prison program. So just like the state IDAs, the women at Coffee Creek make commitments to their education, to budgeting, and to savings. Of course, this looks quite different in a prison setting. Our students complete a 32-week class with all of this homework. They complete a business plan, a transitional plan, a budget, and a savings plan that fits what they can earn in their institutional jobs. If they complete those requirements successfully, we match their efforts with $500, which they can use for reentry needs like tuition at community colleges, rental deposits, work clothes, or phones. We appreciate the state's investment in the IDA initiative, and we take the responsibility for stewardship of these funds very seriously. We think it's a great tool, and we hope the legislature continues to support this in the future.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions of the panel? Representative Widener, a quick one.
Real quickly, this is actually, you guys have brought a very good topic up, and I've been a strong supporter and wondered how to do it, but if anybody's familiar with Dave Ramsey, his Financial Peace University, to me, should be taught in every high school around the state so kids actually have a clue, because I have this battle with my one son who will be a senior next year. Dad, I'll be 18. I can get a credit card. No, you don't want a credit card. So, but unfortunately, we have teachers in the school that are teaching to leverage credit as well. So.
Oh, no. In Mrs. Berger's class, they went through and they found out if they paid the minimum on their on their Visa bill, how much they would have to pay over time. Trust me.
Representative Barton, quickly.
You know, I just wanted to thank all of you guys for the work you're doing, to the previous panel as well. Thank you for coming down. It's really extraordinary work that you guys are doing, and I didn't fully appreciate quite how extraordinary it is, so thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I think what I'm impressed with, absolutely the education component, because you can go through and give people money, but if they don't know how to invest it, what to do with it, how to save, how to go through and have goals as to what they want, then it's kind of not worth it. So I'm very, very impressed with what you do. And anything help we can do, we will try to do it. Okay, other questions? Okay, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
So I'm going to close the informational hearing. And we are going to be carrying over for work session Senate Bill 520 and also Senate Bill 96A. And Senate Bill 96 will be on May 29th. Okay? With that, I adjourn the Committee on House Business and Labor.